Blog Talk Radio.
We've heard all the political announcements. We know about the candidates who are running across the country on both sides of the aisle and as independents. And on Tuesday, November 2nd, the American public will make their choices known. It's going to be a volatile rock and roll Tuesday. Who will win? Who will lose? We're going to talk about this issue and the importance of voting and the impact of the Tea Party on today's show. And we're also going to bring you highlights from yesterday's fantastic fourth multicultural conference that was held at the University of Massachusetts Boston Campus Center. It's going to be a really, really delightful, enjoyable, fun, and exciting show today. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas, and you are listening to Focus on Empowerment, and we are glad that you joined us today. Hello, good afternoon, and we're glad that you joined us. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. We have a very exciting show that we have put together for you today. I don't know where to start. We've had so much to do in the month of October. Things have been popping. There are so many conferences, lots of meetings that I have attended. We held our fourth multicultural conference yesterday, and on next Tuesday, there is an election. So we're going to save all of the conference highlights to talk to you about later on in the hour with Dr. Rhonda Waters and also an interview that we just did earlier this morning with Bill Dunham. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about the election process and what's been going on across the country. I have brought in a leading expert to talk to our group and talk to our listeners about what's happening with the Tea Party, the impact that they are going to have on the election cycle, and what his predictions are in terms of outcome and voter turnout based on what he has seen on Tuesday election landscape. We're talking to Will Bunch, and we want to welcome Will. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters. Hello, Will. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on. I'm also a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News.
There you go.
I always want to make sure I mention both. So
that's right.
They're both important. So thanks for having
Absolutely.
Me on.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you came on in the last minute. I know you're probably doing lots of interviews, and there's so much news going on. Have you seen an election cycle like this one before? I know it's a midterm election. I did a little bit of research in terms of what happened back in the 1966 election cycle, but through the years and the research that you have undertaken, have you seen anything like this before?
No, I think that's a good question. I do think this election is unusual, and you know, it's not just research. I mean, I've lived it. The first election I covered as a journalist was a midterm election back in 1982, and you know, there were so we're talking 28 years ago, and there were some similarities in that election in that there was a lot of concern about the economy. Unemployment was quite high in the middle of Ronald Reagan's first term, but I'd have to say of all the midterm elections that I've covered, which have been a lot, and the ones I'm familiar with before that, this one just seems to have the most. It's had a lot of buildup going into it. You know, there's a lot of voter anger. Seems like people are paying a little bit closer attention than usual. I mean, even in that '94 election, which ended up being a very transformative election, in that Republicans, took control of the House and the Senate together for the first time in a couple generations, and I mean, that was a big deal. But I covered that election, and the build-up to that election was nothing like this. And I just think there's a lot of things that have been building on the electorate. You know, a lot of frustration over the economy.
What is that? You know, again, you can go back now 30 years looking at the work that you've done. What's the it that is so pervasive with what we're seeing with this election process?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good question. I wonder if some of it is just cumulative. That I think frustration has been building, and that there's a lot of frustration with both parties. you know, being unable to either come up with their own solutions, number one, or to work together on a common solution. And I think at various points in the past, I mean, I think voters have responded by saying, well, we'll vote one party out, we'll vote the other one in. And that may happen again this time around with Republicans, just because there's so many vulnerable Democratic representatives out there. But I think it's bigger. I think voters in both sides are angry. Certainly, the progressive circles that I travel a lot in, there's a lot of disappointment with the Democrats for not, being more aggressive these last 2 years when they control the government and not getting more things done. And then there's the Tea Party movement, which I focus on in my book. And I don't know if you mentioned, but I want to make sure people know that I just published a book on the Tea Party movement called The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. So I've spent the last year looking very closely at what's going on with the Tea Party.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to talk with you also,
sure,
in addition to your book. Tell us about, again, this movement. I sort of laughed them off a year ago.
Right.
And I said, this is a very reactionary group, and in about 6 months or so they're gonna fade away and go away. That is not happening at all.
No.
So the work that you're doing and the work that you're seeing in the book that you just published, High Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. What a title.
Yes.
Why has
the
this
backlash
movement,
is the main title.
The
back, yeah, so.
Why has this movement stuck? Why is it so pervasive?
Well, I would say there are a couple things that they have going for it that, if you want to compare it to, like, certain progressive political movements, don't have going for them that they do. One, I think, is just the role of right-wing media. I think the fact that there are, I was going to say four or five, but really two or three or four media figures in particular, Glenn Beck probably being number one, but also Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity.
Right.
These are people that, almost everybody in the movement pays attention to these people and listens to them every day, and it helps them develop a message that, these hosts often kind of pound the same message together over the course of a day, and then people in the movement talk about it with each other, and they talk about it online, and they post these things on Facebook, et cetera. And so there's a very cohesive structure and message in the Tea Party. One other thing that I think we didn't know a lot about at first, but has kind of emerged more recently, is the fact that they also have wealthy supporters willing to help them with an infrastructure.
They have lots of supporters like that. I mean, the money pouring into their movement is astounding.
That's absolutely correct. And one of the one entity that's been getting a lot of attention lately are the Koch brothers, spelled K-O-C-H but pronounced Koch, who run Koch Industries, a large energy oil company based in Kansas, two of the richest people in America, who fund a group called Americans for Prosperity, which what they do is, they provide things like buses, they hold a lot of seminars that teach people how to be better organized and better organizers.
Right.
And these are all things that can help keep a movement together. And so,
to go along with that point, Will, we're talking to Will Bunch with Media Matters and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He is also the author of Philadelphia Daily News. I'm so sorry, Philadelphia Daily News.
I know. Well, I threw that new thing at you, so... Yeah, go ahead.
And he's also the author, I'm going to get this title right now, The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. Did I get that right this time?
You absolutely. Thank you.
Great. Let me share with you something that I'm seeing on the very local level to support what you just said. I live in a town that is fairly conservative. It is predominantly white. I'm an African-American. I'm a progressive. The town typically votes Republican. It also has a Tea Party underpinning at this point. We went to a town meeting about 3 weeks ago, and typically, you know, you may have 100, 200 people who come to the town meeting. Because of the issues that were being presented and an industry that was planning on coming into town, there were 1,400 people who jammed into the auditorium, the gym, and the cafeteria. They had no more room. There was so much opposition to this particular measure of bringing this industry into town. I have never seen how organized this group was. And the vote that finally went down was split. It literally, the town split in half, half and half, half for it, half against it, a little bit more against it, and the whole vote went down, so in flames. So the group, the company is not moving into town. They did the same thing with a school measure. And because I know the Tea Party is here in this town, I said, my goodness, this is happening all over the country. Just this kind of organization, research, a little bit of money here and there, and you literally can influence town policies that are taking place in towns like mine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in my book, The Backlash, one of the things I did is I focused a lot on a particular Tea Party group in the state of Delaware, which not knowing at the time that Delaware was going to become the political capital of the universe, as it turned out. But in fact, I met Christine O'Donnell very early on because of my reporting down there. But but in addition to that, I mean, this group, the Delaware 912 Patriots, I mean, for their own just internal meetings, they routinely get at least 100 and sometimes as many as 200 or 300 people. And these are for their just county chapter meetings, which there's three of. So so we're talking about, you know, 300, 500, 600 people go every month, or every 2 weeks actually going to their meetings. And exactly. they are focusing a lot on local issues as well as the kind of national things that Glenn Beck might be talking about. So absolutely, and I think some of it is one thing I talked about in the book is a lot of the people in the Tea Party movement are at a particular place in life because a lot of them are over the age of 50.
Right.
You have a lot of retirees.
Yes.
You have a lot of people who work part time or they own small businesses. A lot of homemakers. Maybe they've raised kids, but now they're off at college or growing up. And So they're the part of society that might have more time to devote to a movement like that.
Exactly.
You know, one thing, you know, and it's funny, and, you know, actually it's interesting because John Stewart has alluded to this a lot in this rally that he's planning for tomorrow. But people kind of who are more in the progressive coalition, because they're younger, may not be at that same place. They may have they're either working a couple jobs or they have they're in the child raising years, and a lot of us know what that's like, and you don't have a lot of time to go to a protest march or to make up signs or to go to a town meeting, you know.
You literally have validated what's happening here in my town in Lakeville. It is, you have a lot of retirees, and the people who formed the opposition were in that age category. They were over 50. Some of them have retired or they're working part-time. I was amazed with how much time and effort they had put into defeating this measure, and because, I guess, this company, it's Cisco. Cisco underestimated their power. They didn't knock on my door. They didn't knock on the other door, so people didn't know Cisco. I voted for it, but people didn't know who Cisco was, and those who were in the middle or undecided were influenced by the opposition. It was astounding to see it in living color. It was just amazing. Just
well, surprising
amazing.
In this day and age, and anybody would be against new jobs. Even if there were other factors like, you know, congestion or pollution.
In this case, the state property that they in question had been sitting vacant for 20 years with no other offer. So this was an opportunity to develop some land commercially and certainly bring some revenue to the town. But no, the no's won out. So as you're looking at Tea Party activity in Delaware, is it the same out west in California? Certainly we're looking at that race, Nevada, Colorado. Are you seeing the same pattern across the country?
Well, what I've seen and found in my reporting was that as you get further out west, I think you get a little bit more of what you might call libertarian streak to the Tea Party movement, where they're really focused on the idea of, you know, get the government off my backs. You know, this gun issue, which is a big issue for all of the movement, but I think particularly out west, this idea, which is you know, not backed up in reality at all, but this idea that the government has this scheme that they want to confiscate people's guns or they want to confiscate people's ammunition, and so you see out there, there's been a big push in Montana for manufacturing guns in Montana, and saying that you know, if the federal laws don't even apply to guns that are made and sold and stay within the borders of Montana, for example, and you've seen other states copying that, and you see you've seen aggressive legislation like that. Also, as you probably know, the further southwest you get, you know, the more that the immigration issue becomes the driving force behind the Tea Party movement, and that's certainly what I found during the time I spent in Arizona doing some reporting for the book. You know, that I mean, there's definitely a very close association between the Tea Party movement and these laws like the SB 1070 that some of your listeners might be familiar with, that gives the police more power to arrest people they suspect are in the country illegally, and which many people who think the law is a terrible thing, myself included, you know, sees a form of racial profiling.
Absolutely.
And so that's been a big animator. So you see, you know, whereas in the East Coast and somewhere like Delaware or perhaps in Massachusetts or somewhere like that, you're going to see maybe the economic issues a little bit more rising to the forefront. So it's an interesting question, because I think there are, and I certainly found there are some regional differences between the Tea Party,
So with that said, and the work that you're doing, and I appreciate this, you certainly helped to enlighten me, and needless to say, the listeners who are either going to be listening live right now or who will be downloading this show in the next couple of days. What are the big spots in the country, the big states that the listeners should pay attention to? Obviously, going out to vote is I can't say that enough, wherever you happen to live. But where are you paying most attention to in terms of battleground states or very hotly contested races, Wilbur?
Well, I think one of the most interesting races in the country is right here in my own personal home state of Pennsylvania, which is Joe Sestak versus Pat Toomey. And one thing, Pat Toomey's an interesting case because he really ideologically, politically, supports almost all the core issues of the Tea Party. And in fact, he was speaking at the first Tea Parties, and he's closely in line with that movement, but he's also he's a very bright guy, and he hasn't said he hasn't really said any of the wacky things that you've heard from some of these other candidates, like a Sharon Angle out in Nevada, it's funny because our race in Pennsylvania hasn't gotten as much attention, but, the stakes are just as high and the policies that, Pat Toomey would vote for as a senator really aren't going to be that different from what Sharon Angle or Rand Paul of Kentucky might do. I mean, having said that, I mean, like everybody else, I'm paying a lot of close attention to that race in Nevada. But I was going to say other races. I think in Nevada and Kentucky, I think those are both pretty close races. Although I think it looks like Rand Paul is kind of built up a lead in Kentucky.
He's edging up,
Yeah, but
what do you think about Harry Reid and what's going on with him and Sharon Angle in Nevada? I mean, it's neck and neck. It looks like she's a little upped over the last couple of days.
Well, it's funny. In fact, one thing, and I forget about this from time to time, but people point it out on TV, is that Nevada has this unusual thing where it's the one state in the country where you can vote for none of the above, and you're probably going to see a lot of votes for that because, I mean, I think a lot of people – are kind of tired of Harry Reid. He's been around for a while, and we're definitely in an anti-incumbent, you know, kind of throw the bums out mood this year. So that doesn't bode well for Harry Reid. On the other hand, voting for Sharon Angle, I mean, I think, I think middle of the road voters like liberals just find her way too extreme. Some of the things she said. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but I think if I had to bet, I do think Sharon Angle has the edge just because it's such an anti-incumbent year, and which means we're going to have her for 6 years in D.C., which will be interesting. So I think her and Rand Paul or a couple of voices that are people who I think are likely to win on Tuesday, mm-hmm. and I think are going to be kind of leading national voices for better or worse.
And it looks like Barbara Boxer in California is edging out Carly Fiorina.
Yeah, although that race is closer than I would have expected it to be, frankly. But mm-hmm. but you're right. But, you know, I mean, some of the other races that have gotten a lot of attention, this Joe Miller, this Sarah Palin hand-picked candidate
right.
up in Alaska seems to be sinking like a stone in the last few days. And I don't know if that means the current Senator Lisa Murkowski can actually pull off this write-in thing, which is would be pretty unusual. Or, you know, it might be an opening for this previously pretty obscure Democrat named Scott McAdams mm-hmm. who's running.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he definitely has a shot, which is interesting. But,
right.
but you know, the one race, it's funny because as we were alluding to before, I mean, this race, this Senate race in Delaware has gotten so much attention because of the, you know, quirky personality of
mm-hmm. Of the former witch.
Christine
O'Donnell.
Christine O'Donnell. So, I mean, you know, all the polling has suggested there's no way she can win. In fact, if anything, the latest poll that came out just today shows Coons with a bigger lead than ever before. So I don't think there's any, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of Christine O'Donnell in the years to come, but it's going to be as a TV funded and not kind of in the mode of Sarah Palin and not as a U.S. senator. So,
well, Will Bunch, I thank you for painting the picture of what's taking place around the country. Did a great job doing that and really opened my eyes and hopefully the eyes of others in terms of the profile of the Tea Party. It's not one particular party per se. It's lots of different activities going on around the country simultaneously, but the issues may differ across the landscape, but the profile seems to be pretty much the same in terms of the type of person who's involved in that. We've been talking to Will Bunch, who is the senior fellow at Media Matters and also the senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and the author of the new book, The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. Will, thank you so much for being on my show, and we're going to all be up very late on Tuesday night until after
Absolutely.
The election.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's going to be an exciting night. It's going to be an important night for whatever happens. So, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Will. Take care and good luck with your writing.
All right, bye bye.
Well, hopefully, we've given you a sense of what's taking place and what's going on. I can't state enough. How important this election is. It doesn't really make any difference what side of the aisle you're on, if you're in the middle, if you're on the right, if you're on the left, if you've never voted before. Voting now and voting on Tuesday is going to be paramount to the future of the country. Let me tell you what's at stake on the national level, and then we'll drill down and look at what's taking place maybe on some local levels, and we'll definitely talk about what's happening here in Massachusetts over the next few days or so. The election will impact the number of people who are going to be either sent back to Congress or who will be sent packing and will go home. And we just talked with Will about the various elections and the impact of the Tea Party and where we stand across the country, whether you're in Philadelphia or whether you're in Nome, Alaska. So on the national level, right now we know that the Republicans are in the minority, both in the House and the Senate. That will more than likely change as a result of the election on Tuesday. My prediction is that we progressives on the left will probably lose a lot of House seats. And I would predict that the House will then turn over and will become the majority of the political, the congresspersons will be on the Republican side. I think that the Senate will stay the same, where it will be democratically controlled. I'm predicting that's what's going to happen. We'll talk about this next week. But with that will be a split Congress again. I think the country is split. I think Congress will be even more divided just based on what will take place. And getting laws passed will be a little bit more difficult and complicated. which means that the job that President Obama will face after Tuesday's election will make it a little bit tougher and more tricky to get some important legislation passed through in terms of climate control and just some other issues. I am so very glad that the health care bill passed. The concern I have is that if Democrats lose enough seats and then lose the House and lose the Senate, then there may be a movement in place to repeal or get rid of or significantly compromise the health care bill that was passed last year, passed earlier in March. That will not be a good thing. So we've got many things to pay attention to. Who will win? Who will win big? The number of seats that will be lost or gained in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, we have that to think about. We will also have to think about the governor's races across the country. I'm in Massachusetts, and in our race, our governor is running a very spirited race with Charlie Baker and also Tim Cahill. Charlie Baker is a Republican candidate. Tim Cahill is an independent, formerly a Democrat, who is our state treasurer, and pulled out of the party to run on a third platform. Jill Stein is running as a Green Party member. Right now, Tim Cahill, for a number of reasons, too much to talk about now, has lost a lot of ground. It doesn't look like he's going to win. Jill Stein is also way back in the pack. And right now, Deval Patrick, who is the current governor on the Democratic side, is up by a few points over and against Charlie Baker. I think my prediction is that Deval Patrick will win by a very slim margin. But again, it's going to be so important for everybody to come out to vote. So even in Massachusetts, we have some ballot questions that are hot and heavy, all dealing with income and state government and state services. My recommendation, from a progressive point of view, is that those in Massachusetts who are voting to vote no on all three measures. The Greater Boston Interfaith Organization is circulating information encouraging people to vote no on all the question one, question two, and question three. These three questions will devastate, this is information that has been shared, the middle class, the poor, and all who rely on affordable housing and essential services. Question number one would eviscerate state funding for drug and alcohol treatment by restoring a special tax break for the alcohol industry. Question two would take away the opportunities for affordable housing across Massachusetts. And question three would take away more than $2.5 billion from schools, parks, roads, youth programs, and services for seniors. And the measure, these measures are all in place to roll back the taxes, give tax breaks to corporations, which will then impact the services that state government can offer across the board. So my recommendation is to vote no on everything, all three of these ballot questions. And then we have other races going on, which we talked about earlier with Will Bunch. There are races in the South, Kentucky, other parts of the South, Delaware, clearly, with Christine O'Donnell running. Very interesting race. New York, the New York gubernatorial race, I predict that Andrew Cuomo will win. Again, he has some very interesting candidates he's running against, including the Republican candidate. So the long and short is, if you're listening and downloading this show between now and Tuesday, November 2nd, and if you are a U.S. citizen and if you are on the rolls, you need to go out and vote. This is a midterm election like no other. There are many different factors that we're looking at, and it is just, I think, apparent upon all Americans who are of voting age, who are registered to vote at this point in time, to go out and register to vote. Not only register to vote, but go on and vote. It's too late to register at this point, but to go on and vote. Your vote definitely, positively matters across the country, no matter where you live. Look at your ballot questions. Study them very carefully. Look at all the candidates who are running for office. And vote like it matters. Vote and realize that your vote definitely matters no matter who you are, what walk of life you're coming from. And not only think about that, but think about the impact of your vote after November 2nd. If you're angry, emotional, if you have something that you want to get off your chest, and you vote none of the above in the state of Nevada, how is that going to impact the person who most likely will represent your interests? If you look at it from representing your interests and the interests of the betterment of your society and your community, you will vote maturely and intelligently. If you are looking at it from anger and emotion and let's take back our country or the other kind of spin doctor comments that are being made on talk radio, then your vote may not necessarily yield the kind of results that you're thinking of if you're looking at it from an emotional perspective. So, in closing, and we'll talk about this next week, it is so important for you to go out on Tuesday and vote. More than likely, depending on your particular town, you may want to do an absentee ballot if you can on Monday. It just depends on how your absentee ballot system is set up for Monday. Otherwise, go out there on Tuesday and vote. And we will bring you election results and talk more about this next week. We're going to take a little break and then come back. And I think we just lost our guest. I hope that she will call back. Oh, she's calling back. That's good. We are going to take just a very short, quick break and play a little tribute music there and then come back with our special guest from the wonderful conference we had yesterday, the Multicultural Conference. We'll be right back. It's a lot of work to put together a conference. I've been doing conferences for a number of years, and it doesn't necessarily get any easier. The nights get longer. The responsibilities, the little things that don't go quite right, that just continues. But when you package it all together, as we did yesterday, you see the fruits of your labor. I am just delighted and excited to talk with Dr. Rhonda Waters, who is one of our very special distinguished speakers at the fourth multicultural conference that was held at the University of Boston Campus Center. Dr. Waters, welcome to the program again. You've been on before, and we're just glad to have you on again. How are you?
I'm doing terrific, Carol. I want to thank you for the wonderful time I had yesterday. You put on an event. Anybody out there listening, if you have a chance to go to something Carol Thomas has coordinated, you are in for a treat, inspiration, motivation, meet and greet, networking, par excellence. I tell you, Carol, it was a great event. I was so proud to be there, invited to speak, as well as just to be an attendee. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, I tell you, it was great because you were there, and I just know from the downloads that have taken place with the show that you did with me a couple of months ago, they just continue on because we had so much content. We had content speakers, about 24, 25 content speakers in the format of our panel discussion with our opening address with Dr. Keith Motley. He just rocked the house. And then our roundtable discussions. Tell us about the session that you ran, the roundtable discussion.
I ran a very quick job readiness and multiculturalism session, and I talked about why companies care about diversity. And I tell people this idea, which your friend and fellow National MBA Association president, of which I am also a member, Bill told us about businesses care about profit, and I say, and production. Businesses care about production and profitability. If what you want in your company, from your company, with a company, is not tied to those things, you sound like an adult on a Charlie Brown cartoon. All you hear is wah, 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 wah. They are interested in how to make their companies better for their customers and their clients. So when we talk about multiculturalism and diversity, they need to understand how that improves or impacts the bottom line. And sometimes we have to explain it to them. You can't assume that they understand that having two or three people who speak a variety of different languages available not only helps them have people who can call into them have better understanding, but also can reach out to make better sales. And some of them don't actually realize that people on their staffs would do that if they, you know, who are bilingual, trilingual. I mean, many people who speak especially Spanish and Portuguese, who could be tremendous advantages to people in their organization. So you have to understand how to translate things into the business people's language, and you have to learn about their background. A lot of companies that we used to think of as being owned by one family or one group are now owned internationally. So a local supermarket may now be owned, as some of them are here in Massachusetts, are now owned out of Denmark and Sweden.
Right.
So you need to know that that's also multiculturalism. And so some of them may even have a better idea. You need to know about the backgrounds. I talked about ways you can learn about other cultures, that how they meet and greet. And we have our own way of doing things here in the U.S. And I still get a lousy handshake from people. So if you're trying to make a good first impression, it's important to give a firm handshake, not one that just seems to be hanging there. So,
That's very culturally specific, too. I think you make a really good point, Dr. Waters, because in some cultures, if you're female, giving a firm handshake is a taboo. And so if you're born outside of the United States and you come here and live and you work here, it's almost like cultural modification.
Absolutely.
You're divorcing yourself from the cultures that you grew up with so that you can succeed in this particular society. Not an easy feat, but one that has to be paid attention to.
Right, and in some cultures, men and women do not shake hands. It's it's considered to be a violation of their religious custom. Men and women do not touch. So if you're in a country that does that, sticking out your hand, or it may not be the best, for females may not be the best way of doing things. Or on the other hand, if someone is here and hasn't been here very long, they may not have adapted to the change. So if someone says to you, I'm sorry, I cannot shake your hand, don't take it personally. It may be a religious thing with them. It's not, you know, about you, and don't be offended. It's just they have strong religious beliefs and have, you know, they're doing what they believe is right. And there might be a tremendous opportunity, a customer for you if you respond effectively. And, you know, I also talked a little bit about unique selling positions, how that's always in play when hiring, that you, what makes you special, but also adaptable to the organization. Because organizations now, they don't want people who are going to cause a lot of trouble in some regards. They're not going to be aggressive and confrontational. They want people, especially if you're going to work 16, 17 hours a day with people, they want to know you can be got along with. To sort of turn a phrase, that you are going to be friendly, cheerful, and positive in addition to effective and organized.
So
it's not just enough to be there on time and doing stuff, but they want to know that you're going to be a nice person to be with. And that's an important thing to portray. And remember to smile when you talk to people, when you meet them, not all the time, but at least enough for them to know you're friendly. So when dealing with companies, they are hiring, as we as people spoke about at the conference yesterday. Companies are hiring. It's a very long and arduous process, though.
Right, but you know, the thing is, we had Dr. Sandra Casey Buford, who's with Massport, also one of the presenters yesterday. She brought three folders full of job opportunities for Massport. So there were job opportunities yesterday that people could have reviewed and then pursued. So, yeah, the job opportunities are out there. But what I'm hearing from you is that you have to be a smart you have to be a smart job applicant or a smart employee because the job market is so different and so tight at this point in time. The economy obviously is trying to bounce back. The jobs aren't what they used to be, but you just can't take things for granted. You have to, you know, obviously coming to this conference was a great way to stay on your toes, but long after the conference, there are homework things you need to do to stay abreast of what's taking place. And this, I think, is particularly true for people who have been on the job for a long time, and they facing unemployment. They're going to have to do an awful lot just to get abreast of what is current in the workplace.
Yeah, it's important for people.
Go ahead, Ron.
It's important for people who've been even in management positions where they're making good money. A lot of companies have figured out that they can hire three 25-year-olds take the place of one 50-year-old.
That's
and pay the three 25-year-olds altogether less than they paid the 150. You know, because you can get a 22-year-old out of college for $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Kind of hard-pressed to get somebody who feels they're a senior executive with lots of experience. But sometimes when you look at people's information on paper, we don't present ourselves effectively in the online format. A lot of people who are in their 40s and above want to just resume into a company, and that's all they want to do. But that's not how these systems work anymore. You have to apply through companies through their extensive online programs. They expect you to use them effectively. No one takes paper anymore. Even if you have a connection, which is great, in the company, who later on will help, you know, funnel you through the system, you still have to use their system in order to even start the job hiring process.
That's a very important point, too. So many times you have to submit that application online first before anybody will even, you know, pick up your application and review it. And that includes your buddy on the inside who's trying to help you out. So lots of things. Can you share with us the highlights for you with yesterday's conference, in addition, obviously, to being one of our presenters?
I think the networking that you were able to organize by bringing so many diverse people or groups of people together from different companies and organizations of viewpoints, people from within the U.S., people who are immigrants here now, people who are students, that I was able to speak to a broad spectrum of people, and they were able to share their learning with me as well, because it goes both ways. It's not, when you're there to give a presentation, that has one function, but it was also able to be interactive, so I was able to hear from other people what their concerns were around. And one of the things that I keep hearing from people who are bilingual, trilingual, what have you, is many of them are embarrassed about their American accents, and I keep telling them that is never a real problem.
Right.
You have so many advantages. If you're bilingual or trilingual, don't apologize for your accent. Your accent is fine. We wish
Absolutely.
We could speak two or three different languages.
And
so if people have a hard time understanding you, just slow down a little bit. It's not a big deal. But it's certainly nothing to apologize for. That's the kind of diversity that's always a moneymaker for an organization. It's
sure,
always
it's
better to
right
have
it.
More people who speak more languages. So feel free to speak up. You know, even if your English is, your American English is so-called not perfect, it's often not perfect. The people who worry about it are the people who actually usually speak the best.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. They just don't feel they sound like a news anchor. So that's the standard they set for themselves. And a lot of us don't sound like that.
No. And I mean that's okay for broadcasting, but that's not the profile of the variety of Americans we have here in this country. Well, I just thank you so much for, first of all, being there yesterday and delivering such a high-impact presentation on job readiness. Also, thank you for being a member of the symposium series, for the constant flow of content that you always provide for us, and ways to look at things, ways to look at places to work and the kind of preparation you need to have for your next job. And, Dr. Waters, give us your contact information so others can get in touch with you.
I'm available at rfw@mutaregroup.com. Or you can look at my webpage for other information on www.mutaregroup.com. I have a Facebook page on facebook.com/mutaregroup. You can reach me by telephone, 617-266-3057. I'm also on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, some people are telling me they're resistant to being on LinkedIn, but you need to be on if you mean to do something serious in your career. It's on LinkedIn/in/RhondaWatersPhD.
Well, lots of ways to get in touch with you. It's a sign of our times, how you can be connected to other people based on social media platforms. We did talk about that yesterday at the conference. Telephone number, websites, email addresses. That's the world. That's the changing world that we're living in. And I know, Dr. Waters, we're going to bring you back on the air in the next couple of weeks or so to tell us about the latest trends and how that's impacting people on the workplace. Dr.
Rhonda
Waters.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Carol.
Thank you so much for being a guest on my program. You are powerful. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Well, again, we had a little less than 100 people at yesterday's event. The electricity was in the air the entire time. I can't thank the University of Massachusetts enough for hosting our event. Dr. Keith Motley was our opening keynote speaker. Oh, was he electric. Absolutely high-charged and electric. He sort of set the challenge. He looked at himself, his own life as an African-American, rising to the top level of the university system as the chancellor of that particular campus. There are several campuses within the University of Massachusetts system, Dartmouth, Lowell, out in Adams, I believe, Boston. And so these different campuses have different chancellors or presidents that preside over that particular location. And Dr. Keith Motley is over the Boston location. The University of Massachusetts is a teaching hospital, the only public teaching, not hospital, but teaching university, research university. I'm thinking about teaching hospitals in Boston. But I'm looking at them being a research university, the only public research university in the state. And they are very prominent. They are winning awards, Nobel Prizes, et cetera, because of the people that they have and the outstanding leadership team that is on that campus. So hats off to the University of Massachusetts, Dr. Keith Motley, that electrifying message that you delivered yesterday morning. Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to be giving lots of thank yous. We'll thank our sponsors beginning this week and then next week. Certainly want to thank our wonderful, dedicated staff of volunteers and people who just pitch in and help so much. Laura Smith, Robert Smith, oh, they did an awesome job, as Laura was our MC and Robert did a lot of our photography and video work as well. They're a dynamic team up in Lowell, Massachusetts. The exciting thing is that our conference had people all over the state who attended and those who came from outside of the state. Angela Bukenya, who was with the UWADA group, the Ugandan organization, was one of our presenters. She flew in despite all the weather problems on Wednesday from Spokane, Washington, got delayed in Minnesota, and then eventually got here about 6 o'clock or so on Wednesday, did a dynamic job with her presentation on community outreach and international issues. We also had Bill Wells, who was our closing speaker, the national chair of the National Black MBA Association, challenging us and looking at the response of corporations and the response that we all have to multicultural issues. He really definitively had us to look at our responsibilities as professionals, as people who want to grow and change, and what that would mean to the workplace. So thank you so much for him. So again, we're going to continue our thank yous next week because I want to play another special interview I did just a little while ago with Bill Dunham, who was a participant in yesterday's conference, William P. Dunham, otherwise known as Bill. I'm delighted to have on my show today someone who attended the conference yesterday, is a member of the Multicultural Symposium Series, certainly has that interest in his heart, and has an extensive background in state government, doing lots of work with diversity and other issues related to diversity and inclusion in state government here in Massachusetts, now a consultant working in the field. William P. Dunham, Jr., otherwise known as Bill, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Well, tell us, was this your first, second, third, or fourth multicultural conference with us? I know that you've been a member for a while.
This was actually my second conference, but I've attended a number of your workshops over the years, and you've become my favorite professor.
Thank you so much. Tell me a high point from yesterday. I've been telling my audience that there was a lot of electricity in the air. Not sure if it was the actual location since we switched. We enjoyed ourselves at Bentley University and now enjoying ourselves at UMass Boston. What was the high point for you yesterday, Bill?
Well, I'd like to note, probably as you just mentioned, two very special schools, and both presidents I've had the opportunity to meet, and Gloria Larson from Bentley College, a very dedicated, outreaching individual, and her staff. And I look at it this way: as you are on second base, you have partnerships with them. I'm quite sure they'll work with you in the future.
Right.
And then this terrific opportunity working with UMass Boston, which when I was in state government, I did a lot of partnerships, youth programs with them, a very special school. And when you're asking me what caught me most is the whole tone, the dynamics there, from your MC, Laura Smith, and then who could imagine the impact the Chancellor Motley has electrified the whole crowd, all of us. He really is a caring person, committed, and you felt like he was talking to each one of us.
Right. Well, I mean that really sums it up quite nicely. Again, two very great schools. And what I find very unique about UMass Boston, as you have said, they really do have this partnership quality about them. They're a research university, one of the top now named in the United States, and it extends itself to a lot of different disciplines and fields so that our whole conversation about multiculturalism fits in very well with what they have been doing as a university. Tell us about the roundtable discussions that you attended.
Yes, that's, I want to add, I've, as a former director of training of a major state agency, I've run all kinds of symposiums and events. And you found a way where, yes, we have the people speaking from the lectern, giving their insights on different issues, but a way to take it down to the ground level with round tables where all of us at the program could be participating and interacting with each other was just priceless. And I must admit, I found this one table on personnel development, which in a globally dispersed and diverse world really was an area of interest to me due to my background in human resources and development issues, operations, and what dynamic leaders we had with a Dr. Sandra Casey Bulford from the Massport.
Right.
And then we had Georgina Melendez from the Compact at the...
So, yeah, right, Dr. Sandra Casey Buford from Massport and Georgiana Melendez from the Commonwealth Compact, yes.
And what found out is a subtitle you could almost have to this conference is the networking. Such diversity there of cultures, backgrounds, experiences, different agencies, different nonprofits, and what they brought to the table. And this particular area, she really talked about how you work with an organization, how if you had trouble with a particular supervisor, how people resumes today should fit today's world. And then in the case of Ms. Buford, she just said, I'm here. If you need any more assistance, send me an email, give me a call. It's all up to you. And then Ms. Melendez, you know, they say enthusiasm is contagious. I've never seen a lady so enthused about her job. We all love the dean of the McCormick, Dean Crosby, a very special man, and just the fire she had about her work because the Compact, what it deals with on us all reaching out, all different organizations in the greater New England area, on increasing diversity, hiring, working together on it, tracking it, and a real teamwork aspect.
Well, you've pretty much summarized it, and I love the fact that the way you have captured a description of the roundtables, this particular one where you sat through two presenters and the information that they were sharing, but also the fact that you could continue the relationship with them after the conference had ended. That's exactly what we want to have happen.
I must add that in the case of Ms. Melendez, you know, I've been so intrigued what she does. I've got to know a lot of people in the McCormick Institute, but her schedule has been busy.
Yes.
Now she says, don't worry, Bill, you make the call and we'll meet.
And see, that's the wonderful thing about the symposium series and the people that you meet and the continued relationships that you have, too. That is quite exciting to know. Anything else you want to add about the experience yesterday, another high point?
Well, I have to add, you know, I have an honor of meeting many great, interesting people in my years in government and also just being involved in various nonprofits around the New England area. Is one organization through you I've been also involved in is the Boston chapter of Black MBAs.
Yes.
And to have the actual chair of the whole program flown in to be our speaker at lunchtime was a thrill. He has had such a life and can relate to people, and his whole approach on furthering education, but also acknowledging how an organization needs to stay up with the times, that the best way to capture people for an organization is hit them when they're in school. So the Black MBA organization, I was very impressed, has established chapters in many colleges of the country now.
Exactly. And again, he is so grounded, has been a part of the organization for such a long time, but still has the outreach approach where you can talk to him, you can see his vision, and want to be a part of the experience and to be a part of the Black MBA Association. So you captured it all for us. We thank you so much, Bill, for sharing your insights about yesterday's conference, and we wish you the very best.
My pleasure, and always a great to speak with you.
Super. Well, there you have it. That's from the perspective of Bill Dunham, who has come to a previous conference, is a member, is just really fired up and ready to go as a result of the learnings yesterday. Very special thanks to our Patriot sponsor, Amtrak. They were there in numbers. Prince Reed was on our panel yesterday as well, and Richard Pescatore was there before he had to go back to work, but they are always very supportive, and they always represent and show that they believe and they are committed to multiculturalism, diversity, and inclusion. Our champion sponsors were DePew. We thank them very much, the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau, and always King Printing. Tom Campbell had his table yesterday, and we thank him so much. Our builder sponsors, the Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, they have been sponsoring our webinars all year long, and also Monster.com, back again for a second year. Our roundtable sponsors, Bunker Hill Community College, so all of our roundtables, 9 of them yesterday, were all sponsored by Bunker Hill. And all the packets and the souvenir journal and all the other materials were underwritten by our conference kit sponsor, CVS, the Greater Media Boston, Laura Smith Fund, and MBCR. That's the train company, the commuter rail company. We had fabulous exhibitors there. Denise Montgomery, who is with Mary Kay Cosmetics, had a wonderful table and gave away a big, big basket of goodies that went to our volunteer, Andrea, who is a student at the university. There she won a great big basket that she'll have fun with all weekend and well beyond with all the goodies that were in them. And we also had a beautiful piece of jewelry that was donated by Silpata Designs, and Janice Wright is the owner of Silpata Designs. And if you receive my newsletter, you're going to receive some information about how you can go to her website. That's mysilpada.com/Janice Wright, Janice.Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. You can go and download her, look at her catalog, order information, mention the Multicultural Symposium Series. When you do that, what she does is donate the proceeds to the Kenya Sisters. That's the organization that takes care of children and women in the country of Kenya that I am a part of. And so we have some great partnerships with companies like Silpata Designs that are giving back to the community, giving to international efforts. And so we'd love to have you to continue to work with and to partner with our organization so that others can benefit as well. So, again, special thank you to Dr. Keith Motley, to Chris Hogan. These are all the fabulous friends we now have at UMass Boston. Patricia McNeil, Allison Duffy, Kay Ryan. Thank you, advertisers, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Wheelock College, Davis Funeral Home, and UnityFirst.com. And very special thank you to my daughter, Michelle Thomas, for all that work you did the late nights. Michelle Jackson, can't thank you enough for being there for us and being our registrar yesterday. The UMass Boston Orville Wright and those great students who perform for us during our setup time and our networking, every single speaker who attended and participated with our conference, we had a great time. Dr. Keith Motley, thank you, thank you, thank you. Bill Wells, thank you, thank you, thank you. And every single person who participated, all 25 speakers who were a part of that very exciting day yesterday. We're going to post more about the conference on our website. We're working dutifully to get the new website launched, and so if you missed the conference, if you become a member, you have access to information going forward. There's just a lot going on, and we are just excited to bring you the news and to be a part of your life and to share with you some of the ins and the important aspects of who we are as professionals, who we are as community leaders, who we are as citizens of the world. And those of you who are listening to this between now and November 2nd, make sure you go out and vote on Tuesday. It's that important. Have a great weekend, and we'll check in with you next Thursday at 1 p.m., back to our regular time, Thursday at 1 p.m. Have a great one. Take care. We'll see you later.